Senator Gravel, at a forum earlier this year, I want to get this right. You said it doesn't matter whether you are elected president or not. So then, why are you here tonight? Shouldn't debates be for candidates who are in the race to win the race?
Ryan, you're right. I made that statement. But that's before I had a chance to stand with them a couple, three times. It's like going into the Senate. You know, the first time you get there, you're all excited. My God, how did I ever get here? Then about 6 months later, you say, how the hell did the rest of them get here? And I got to tell you, after standing up with them, some of these people frighten me. They frighten me. When you have mainline candidates that turn around and say that there's nothing off the table with respect to Iran, that's code for using nukes, nuclear devices. I got to tell you, I'm president of the United States. There will be no preemptive wars with nuclear devices. To my mind, it's immoral, and it's been immoral for the last 50 years as part of American foreign policy.
Let's use a little moderator discretion here. Senator Gravel, that's a weighty charge. Who on this stage exactly tonight worries you so much?
Well, I would say the top-tier ones. They've made statements. Oh, Joe, I'll include you too. You have a certain arrogance. You want to tell the Iraqis how to run their country. I got to tell you, we should just play get out.
Okay, so I am here with Senator Mike Gravel as well as Joe Loria, who are the authors of A Political Odyssey. Gentlemen, how are you doing?
Fine. Thanks for having us here.
Very good.
The first question I should probably ask both of you, since this was a collaboration, I suppose I could ask a question to both of you. Do you have the same answer, or do you have the same brain here, or what's the situation?
Same brain.
Yeah.
He met me, listened to me on the trail, and felt that our views ideologically on the issues that face mankind, face the nation, we're the same, and that's what captured him, and so he can speak for himself. That's what he had to figure out. Well, boy, what moves this guy? Yeah. And he kept asking me, well, why do you think the way you think? I don't know why I think the way I think. You figure it out.
Now you do. Haven't read the book.
Gotcha. Well, the first thing I actually want to ask you two about is the national initiative suggesting that essentially citizens should be in the position to propose, alter, or nullify legislation. But I have to ask, given the amount of paperwork, bureaucracy, unreliable Diebold voting machines and the like, I mean, how do you get something like this implemented here in the nation and in collaboration with a constitutional process? I mean, Article 1 says, well, the House of Representatives and the Senate should be in the position of legislative powers that are guaranteed, of course, in the Constitution. How does this relate to what the people have to say?
Well, of course, when the Constitution was ratified, it was ratified by the elites in convention, and that didn't happen by accident. They didn't want the people to ratify the Constitution because the people would not have ratified the Constitution. This happened in 1778 in Massachusetts, and they refused to ratify it because it had slavery. And say they knew that the Constitution would not be ratified because it had slavery in it. And so they had to devise a way to do it. And so they devised a way that the elites would rule the society. And so in Article 7, which is the creation article, they fixed it so the people wouldn't be involved in a process. And so the people would be denied the ratification or the creation aspect of the government. And so we were denied the right to make laws, when in point of fact, all of the founders felt that the people should be lawmakers. It said it very clearly, that we should be able to change our government in succeeding generations to satisfy our happiness. And they did not put the procedures in to do that, because had they given the people the procedures to make laws, we'd have done away with slavery right from the get-go.
But an initiative on a national level to enhance or nullify legislation, I mean, how would you incorporate this in the light of unreliable voting methods currently?
Well, it's the reason why we have unreliable voting methods is because the Congress does not want to empower the people. This is not by accident. This is one of the procedures that was put in place to safeguard slavery. Why does it make any sense to be able to have federal elections conducted and controlled by state and local authority? Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's so that you can keep control of states' rights. in the hands and juxtaposed so you don't have control, don't let the feds keep control. This was how you kept control of slavery.
That's all well and dandy, but the question is how would you deploy a national initiative? That's what I'm really curious about.
Well, real simple. You turn around, create an electoral trust to conduct all initiative elections, one central authority, one central national computer. Everybody is registered for life rather than the silliness that we have that you're registered, and if you move across the street into another district, you got to re-register again. Yeah, all the devices are there to make it difficult for people to participate in the electoral process on purpose. We could all be designed to be able to register on election day, but of course they don't want to do that. That'd make it too easy for you to participate. Then you got to get out and vote on a rainy Tuesday, stand in line, sometimes for hours on end to vote, and then they run out of ballots and you can't even vote. You think this is an accident? This is on purpose.
Well, slavery, as Mike has pointed out, for example, that the states control federal elections rather than the federal. The Senate is a legacy of slavery. The Electoral College is a legacy of slavery. Right. I think there's a couple.
And Article 5, the amendment process is the legacy of. There were five areas of the Constitution that were all put in place to lock in slavery, and there's only one that's been repealed. And that's that a slave is 3/5 of a person. All the other four are still in the Constitution, causing unbelievable mischief and undemocratic processes in our government. They're all there.
Let's talk about the military-industrial complex, which, of course, this book deals with at length and will probably involve both of you. You point to the clear fact that the defense budget nationally went down shortly after the Civil War. The figures you quote accurately, I checked up, is $1 billion in 1865, $57.7 million by 1870. But what is the significant difference between the increasing budget in the 20th century and the Civil War? I mean, what ultimately is the linchpin? Is it this relationship between private contractors and government, or is it something else? Maybe
Joe,
you can elaborate.
The symptoms of the relationship, I think it was at the end of the Second World War, there was a fear there would be a depression again. There was a long depression, and was no question that the military industry got us out of the depression and the war ended the depression, and it was a just war. The war ended. There was actually a fear that, well, what was the unknown? Now that the war is over, perhaps we'll go back to a depression, coupled with the enormous profits and wealth that was accrued and power by the United States left undamaged in a completely devastated world. What did they do with this power and wealth when the war ended? Did they use that to help human progress at home and abroad, or did they just use it to pursue more power and wealth? I think it was just too tempting for them to give it up, coupled with the fear of going back to an economic disaster as we had before the war, that the civilian economy was not brought back in the same way it had been in previous wars. When the Civil War ended, those companies, as they wrote, they made rifles and cannons, made bicycles and sewing machines, and they went out of business, a lot of them.
Yeah.
This did not happen in the Second World War. Harry Truman is really responsible for this, and I hope I could find it, because he essentially admits, have you seen that? In his memoir, that it was all a fraud, that all was all a scare tactic. How do you get the people to agree to pay for all this, to transfer their wealth into the pockets of the arms industry, except to scare the hell out of them that there's going to be a war in any minute? We're going to be invaded. The Soviet Unions are going to take us over. They've infiltrated the government. We got McCarthy going mad on that. So all that madness, I think, was after a while self-fulfilling craziness, but mostly a pursuit of continual profit. They just won the war, and they had all this power, and what did they do with it? They were tempted to build empire, basically. Right, Mike?
That's right. And what happened was that the first person to truly understand it was one of the great military leaders of our time, which is Dwight Eisenhower. And Eisenhower looked upon his great legacy not building up the military machine, but building up a highway system, a transportation system which lowered the cost of human production and capability, increased the capability of our citizenry. So the decision that had to be made in our society after the Second World War, are we going to take this unbelievable economic potential that we demonstrated that we had in the Second World War, are we going to continue to keep that going with military capability, or are we going to turn that and cause it to now concentrate? And we did to a degree. You recall in the Eisenhower era, we had this built up a desire for consumer goods. And it was a very prosperous period under Eisenhower that we had. But then the beginnings of the warfare state, the beginnings of the national defense state that started with Truman carried over. And then you had a little recession. And then you had now the Korean War. That ginned up the military establishment. And then Eisenhower tried to get a handle on it by keeping the cost of war down by increasing our nuke capability. And so now you have nuke expansion, you had the normal expansion of the contractors, and then Eisenhower warned of that. He saw this coming down as a very unhealthy situation. Isn't it interesting that the two major military presidents that we had warned us of foreign entanglements and the military, and it was George Washington and Dwight Eisenhower, the two greatest military leaders. And now what's happened is Dwight Eisenhower warned us. That warning has come to pass. We have a military culture that has captured us lock, stock, and barrel, and not a president since has even acknowledged the problem.
But what gets me about this conundrum is the fact that, well, this buildup after World War II also came after the WPA programs and many of the New Deal programs that allowed Americans to get jobs so that they could also simultaneously improve the country. And the notion of improving the country became related to building up arms, building up munitions, building up weapons. I mean, surely if Eisenhower can say that this is not a good idea, why didn't this stick? Does the public simply have no collective memory? Does it have no sense of its own history of what has worked? That there are better ideas other than defense?
Fear took over. Fear became the coin of the realm of politicians. Politicians find it easier to sow fear than to sow the positive. And that's what really took over. Keep in mind now what happened after Truman. Truman started the fear, and he started it trying to scotch McCarthyism. Then McCarthyism took over, the craziness of the McCarthy era. And then it even bit Dwight Eisenhower. To a degree. Marshall, who was the one who made Eisenhower, didn't even defend George Marshall when he was attacked by McCarthyism. And then after that abated, the fear continued. And then the military people, and you see it now, and of course we've had the whole Vietnam era, the communists, we had to fear communism, and then the Cold War, that the communists were everywhere, and then the intelligence community fed it. We were always afraid of the communists, that they were going to, and of course we had more to fear from our own military than the communists. The communists were never really a threat to us.
You see, in 1948, the aircraft industry was collapsing after the war. And there's a great book that I quote from extensively that showed that this was completely manufactured by testimony by generals, General Chamberlain, and Symington, before he changed, said that the Soviet Air Force was superior, the Soviet subs were sighted off our coasts. It's all nonsense. It's purposely drummed up to get the defense budget that Truman needed. And then when Truman retired and he was back in Independence, Missouri, and he wrote his memoirs. He wrote this: the demagogues, crackpots, and professional patriots had a field day pumping fear into the American people. Many good people actually believed that we were in imminent danger of being taken over by the communists and that our government in Washington was communist riddled. So widespread was this campaign that it seemed no one would be safe from attack. This was the tragedy and shame of our time. This is Truman, who started it, admitting it.
Yes,
and now look at what happened. You could carry that same mantra. That mantra is so embedded in the American psyche today that you could now carry that forward and say that a guy like Saddam Hussein, who's got no capability at all, none at all, and you could repeat that to the American people, that he is a threat to every single American citizen. And it washes. People believe this. Or you could now say that Ahmadinejad in Iran is a threat to every single American. They're saying that today, and Americans believe that, and it is patently ridiculous. It's ludicrous.
And what's the symbolism they use? The symbolism they use is Hitler. They're all Hitler. Noriega was Hitler. Saddam was Hitler. They keep fighting World War II over and over again, a justified war. They're fighting unjustified wars by dressing it up as the war that the Americans supported and would continue to support. And the press is falling down, obviously. In all you need is knowledge to dispel this fear. The reason we're afraid is because we don't know any better. Whatever you're afraid of is because you don't know. You investigate something, usually your fear is dispelled. The press is not doing that. They're using themselves as a conduit for this fear and the propaganda for the false wars, rather than examining the lies that back up these wars. And of course, Iraq is only the latest example of that.
Oh, in Iran. Here, right in Congress right today, you have a resolution by a New York congressman by the name of Ackerman, who wants, and look at, there's over 200 co-sponsors in the House, and they want to have a blockade, a naval blockade around Iran, which is an act of war. Right now, yeah. And it's going to pass in the Congress, and they think that, well, don't do it by force, but a naval blockade is an act of war. It's a forceful act.
Firing off 9 missiles, what Iran did today, was purely to show the Americans don't be so rash, because we could defend ourselves. That was a defensive move, purely. They don't want a war, Iran.
Of course they don't, but Iran is not Syria. Iran will defend itself, and they are attacking Iran. Now, this is the Congress. This is the Democratic Congress that campaigned that they're going to end the war in Iraq, and they are in the process of initiating a war with Iran, which has not been to war in the last 200 years, except to defend themselves from Saddam Hussein, who we incited to attack Iran. It doesn't get any more ludicrous and stupid than this, than a national policy. This is not George Bush. This is the Democratic Congress that is doing this.
All well and good, and I agree with you that we do indeed live in a culture of fear. But if we live in a culture of fear, we also live in a culture of information. So I'm wondering if this has essentially sustained itself over the last several decades. I mean, essentially, Americans have grown up constantly living in fear. Is the responsibility of just your typical American to not live in fear? And why do they continue to live in fear? I mean, if they're so conditioned to do this, and if the information is out there, if they refuse to grasp at the information, is it a case that, like Jefferson said, Americans more or less deserve the government that they get?
Of course they do. And when they go to the airport and they line up like a row of ducks, thinking that this is what we have to do because the government tells us that we're safe by taking our shoes off and pouring out the liquid. We pour out our water, go through the gate, and then go put some more water in or buy some more water on the other side. This is ludicrous. This is totally ludicrous. We've now know that Homeland Security has joined the Pentagon. It is not auditable. We don't know where the money is going. And you're not any safer. They're not any safer at all. This is feeding the contractors. Here, want to know the latest? They've got a new machine. You're going to go stand in this machine, and your wife will be undressed. And so there'll be some other person in the room who'll be able to see your wife naked. It's called peekaboo.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how you feel about that. But I know that some Muslims aren't going to stand for this. But then again, we're persecuting Muslims wholesale in this country anyway. It is the fault of the American people. Who else is to blame?
Yeah.
Well,
it
is the fault of the American people. I would disagree with Mike a little bit, because members of the media are also American people. But I think they bear more responsibility.
Oh, there's no question.
They are supposed to challenge authority.
And they don't.
You'll see that they had a brief period in that 70s era when Mike was in the Senate.
Yes.
That in the Pentagon Papers, and we did give some praise then. But after that, it was just what they're doing is absolutely not doing their job to inform the American people. Hence this book. I'm not saying we're going to make up for our bad press, but hopefully there's knowledge in here to help dispel the fear. that they're giving you, that it's all a fraud. When you know there's nothing to be afraid of, when you grow up, you don't believe in the boogeyman anymore because you know there's nobody in the closet, in the dark closet.
Yeah.
And that's what you need, the knowledge. People have to grow up. And Mike talks eloquently about that in terms of national leadership, again, getting out of civic adolescence. You grow up, you need knowledge. So for that to work, you also need a press that's going to do its job the way it's supposed to and stop running after celebrity and big salaries and careerism. I think that's spoiled it.
What specific remedy is there to ensure that the media is going to do its job, that the people will eventually wake up, so to speak, and not live in particular fear? That's the question. We all agree, I think, that everybody is living in fear.
There's only one remedy. There's only one remedy. Exercise power. The people have no power. All you do on election day is for a few seconds is vote for a politician, and you give your power away. They go make laws, and all you can do is obey the laws or go to jail. You have to become a lawmaker. That's the reason why I keep shouting from the rooftops, you have to become a lawmaker. That's the power of government. And the only way you can do that is to vote for the national initiative. That's the reason why I ran for president. That's the reason why the people in Congress don't want my voice to be heard. That's the reason why the people on Wall Street don't want my voice to be heard. That's the reason why the media don't want my voice to be heard. Because when the people have the power to make laws, their power is diluted. The Congress's power is diluted. And all the people have to do is to reach for this legislation and vote for it. It's all in this book. It's the companion book to this Odyssey book. It's Citizen Power. Mm-hmm. And people can buy it at citizen-power.us, and we'll hopefully be selling some of those books today.
But in the meantime, while there is no national initiative, what can Joe Sixpack do? I mean,
nothing but suffer the consequences. Nothing.
That the national initiative is the only option, really?
What else is the only option is for people to be empowered. Mm-hmm. What other option is there? More of the same? Representative government? What else is there? There's only two venues for change. Representative government, where the problem exists, or empowering the people. Is there another venue? I don't know of any other venue.
Truth-telling in writing and in journalism and in the media. And we have to have that people to understand that their interests are not the same as those of the elite. That they're different. They're not being represented by a Congress that is bought. The reason the people... Mike wants the people to make the laws is because right now who's making the laws? The very wealthy who can afford the lobbyists to get the laws that they want. And they care a lot about the laws. Otherwise, they wouldn't be spending that money on the lobbyists. They make the laws and they act behind those laws. They're the laws to protect their own behavior. We got to put an end to that. But I think that information is really key because people have to come out. For example, in the meantime, a week out of work, American somewhere in middle America, when he watches that missile going down the tube in that house and blowing up in the first Gulf War, some of them may have felt a vicarious thrill. Look what we're doing to them. We've got to put a stop to that because they are not fighting those wars for us.
We were talking initially just now about the celebrity culture that unfortunately not only enters media but also politics. And yet you, Senator Gravel, have actually had two films on YouTube that were inarguably known more for their conceptual approach, almost Andy Warhol-like, rather than the substance of your particular positions. Likewise, when you ran for senator in Alaska, you had this 30-minute film called Man for Alaska, which inarguably helped you to get elected. So how much of this celebrity notion must you actually use or utilize? You can't have it entirely both ways here.
I need a lot of celebrity. I do need it both ways.
Even Obama girls?
Very much so. The reason why I'm being interviewed by you and consent to this, and Joe also, we're trying to get celebrity visibility with you to be able to sell this book so that people can become acquainted with the facts in question. And then I'm going to continue to do
culture.
This. Because here, you won't pay attention.
Yeah.
You can't, if you don't have any visibility, you can't get your message across. But now we have a message. It's a little different from Obama's message. He's talking about change. There's no change in what he's going to do. There's none at all. We're talking about change. Where I'm saying that I want to empower you to make laws in partnership with your elected officials. That's change. There's nobody else talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
All they're talking about is the same old, same old.
On the subject of Senator Obama, has he been in touch with you? When was the last time he...
Of course not. He would not get in touch with me. He doesn't even understand what I'm talking about.
Have any of the... former presidential.
That's how you spoke to him.
Yeah, that's what I'm curious.
Was on stage at Howard University or after that?
And on the stage, that was it. That was the stuff. I've never talked with him. Other than in debates, when I asked him, who the hell are you going to nuke, Barack? Who are you going to nuke? He said, oh, I'm not going to nuke anybody. Next thing I would have asked him, but he walked away, was then why do we have to have over 10,000 nuclear devices pointed at people around the world? Why? That's an interesting question. Why do we need to spend more money on defense than all the rest of the world put together? Who are we afraid of?
When you shifted your presidential candidacy to the Libertarian Party, you ended up placing fourth, and you essentially said at the end that I'm done with politics. Are you done with politics?
I'm done with the electoral politics. I never want to run for anything in my life again. I never really wanted to run for president, but it was the only way I could get celebrity attention on the national initiative, which is what I view as important. Not me. I want to empower you. I want to empower the American people. But now how am I going to empower them? I have to have them become aware that they are the answer. Not me, not Obama, not the Congress. That's not the answer. They're going to do the same old, same old. Where the answer is the people have to realize with knowledge, and they don't even have to have knowledge. They intuit. They know they're getting screwed by the government. They know it. All they got to do is have power to be able to do something meaningful. And knowledge is not power, not if you can't make laws.
In terms of the period of your life between 1981 and most recently, I noticed that you, when you wrote the book together, you left out a lot of how you personally were affected, how you were essentially done with politics, and you concentrated more, of course, on Reagan's invasions of various places and the like, and Bush's policies, and I'm wondering why you didn't really dwell upon this that much. I mean, was it just a matter, or was this really not important, like, as you're saying to me, that the National Initiative sort of trumped all, that your own anger for the current inefficiencies of politics is what essentially motivated
Joe, Joe knew from the get-go that I was not into a memoir, and I'm still not into a memoir. I'm into projecting across experiences that inform us for what we should do in the future. That's what it's all about. And Joe, fortunately, we have a partnership of a guy who's very knowledgeable. He was an intelligence source for me since he was hanging out at the UN. He's a writer. He's as knowledgeable about these areas. Here, I have an intelligence background. He's been working in intelligence from his vantage point from the get-go. And so it was a natural union of ideas and with the same goal in mind. I have honed a process of empowering the people. He's honed his knowledge of repertorial, and he's got a better style of writing than I have. I have clarity, and that's the best I can do. He's a writer. He makes his living at it.
I used to say he wrote a book.
And so now he's written a book that's got a lot of charm, a lot of style to it. It's our hope that it'll be a bestseller. My citizen power is a polemic.
Yeah.
And I'm going to write another book. It's going to concentrate on empowering the people. But the answer is not Joe. It's not me. It is you. The people have to become empowered. And they've got to realize they are the answer, not your leaders. I can't shout this. And people are insecure. Well, I can't believe that we can admit that I can vote to amend the Constitution. Well, if you can't, who can? Who can?
But if you do not matter, then why then do you have escapades of you driving to Alaska? Escapades is probably the wrong noun to use, but these adventures. But they are adventures.
It's a story. Yeah. It's a story, and people love stories. Well, I love.
I can answer that. I use Mike's life as a vehicle to tell this larger story, and he had an interesting life. But like Mike says, it's not that personal. It's not really a biography. I don't go into his personal relationships too much. Some about his childhood, because I think it was important to show what kind of a politician and man he became. But it's mostly a story to weave in, a personal story that people could follow with a lot of history and current politics that would be dry maybe otherwise. That's what I attempted to do anyway.
Your own, essentially, again, using the notion of celebrity to...
Keep in mind, there's two facets.
I really hate that dominant culture of celebrity. We're fighting against it, but using it while we're fighting against it in a way.
This is not the celebrity of Britney Spears. This is not the celebrity of... You have to have a certain visibility, better than celebrity. people have to have, you have to have a visibility for people to notice you. Now, are you interesting when they notice you? And if there's interest, then they'll pay attention to you. Now, if you're just a Britney Spears, then there's an interest. That's not the interest I try to engender. Now, when I was getting a lot of attention on the internet, I had a very simple criteria. It had to be dignified. It had to be funny, because I'm very humorous. In fact, I like to be humorous. And it had to have an edge on issues. That's it. And so when these young teachers came to me and said, we want to film you throwing a rock into water. And immediately that caught me. A rock creates ripples. And so they had a metaphor that they flattered me with, and that was to focus on something with intensity, throw a rock in the water, create ripples, and march off to your demise. That's a metaphor that affects every human being on Earth. That's what we do with our lives. We focus on something important, do it, hope we affect others beneficially, and go off to our demise.
I would like to add something about the issue of celebrity, that before the 1920s, you became known because you did something that had an impact on people's lives, good or bad. Became infamous or famous because you had a lot of impact. But since the 20s, and now, certainly now, with public relations industry that has grown up, you don't have to do anything. It can create you into somebody. People like Britney Spears, now, I'm sorry to say, I don't think they sing very well, or Madonna. But it doesn't matter. You don't need to do anything that helps anyone. They just create a persona and drive it to you, and they can make a lot of money off of that. And that's what we have, and the lucky young woman gets chosen to be that, whether she could sing or not, usually has to look good. So what we're talking about now is not that kind of celebrity at all. I hope that there's some substance to this book, and certainly substance to Mike's career. Yeah. And the fact that we get known for writing this book, for Mike's life, and what he's talking about is the issue. We need people to learn what our ideas are, to dispel the fear with the knowledge that we're trying to give out. That's a totally different kind of celebrity.
Perhaps I should clarify the definition of celebrity here. I'm talking about the based on a true story. I'm talking about the young guy working in France as a counterintelligence agent. I mean, this to me
It's a good story.
Isn't that better to talk about his life than just what happened in the Cold War? There's a lot about the origin of the Cold War in this book, as you know.
Yes.
Well, Mike was part of that in a small way, but he was there in Europe. Following around French communists, and that was what I was. I weaved it in together with the origin of the Cold War. So his life moves in, hopefully seamlessly, with the history that I tell.
But even this conceptual video that you're talking about, and yes, it's certainly a concept, some people ridiculed this. It was not one of these universal messages. It was a very idiosyncratic, and I happen to like it personally, but nevertheless, some people thought, and they laughed at the fact that you were staring your face into the camera like that.
And I thought it was stupid when I was doing it. That's right. But then again, I wasn't focusing on what I was doing. I was just doing what these young people asked me to do. It was only later that I figured out that it was a metaphor.
Is this how you inure yourself from this notion of celebrity within politics, of having somebody else do these things and not being aware of them?
No. This, you got to keep in mind that I understood the ripples in the water. I didn't put the whole thing together. And when they were filming it, I was so busy thinking of other problems that I didn't pay any attention. I just had confidence in them. They were teachers of art and technology. I was very impressed with that, putting that together. And so I just had confidence that these young men were serious and would do a good job. It was only later, when the media started paying attention to this metaphor, that I said, hey, I better figure out what they were talking about. And I was too embarrassed to even call them and say, well, what were we doing? I've had to figure it out.
Yeah.
And then that's when the world had to figure it out, and they were doing the right thing.
Yeah. A question to both of you. The modifier that frequently ripples, so to speak, throughout this book in relation to war is unnecessary. You question Woodrow Wilson's motives for getting us into World War I, writing that America was not threatened. Yet I must bring up the bombing of the Lusitania, and I must also point out that there was the Kingsland explosion, the Zimmerman telegram. I mean, what is a necessary war? Was America really not at threat in World War I?
Of course it was not.
Well, I'll just say briefly, I deal with the Zimmerman telegram. It was absolute nonsense. Why did Wilson send ships into the areas where they could be sunk?
That's right. And there was an argument that it had, munitions.
Yeah.
I mean, here, Woodrow Wilson didn't have to go into the First World War at all. In fact, had he not gone in, there's a chance we'd have never had the Second World War. Had we let them, that was their war, let them bleed themselves out, would you realize that after the First World War, the democracies of the world were in command of the world, and who screwed up the 20th century but the democracies? Clemenceau and the British and ourselves were the one that set up the debacle of the 20th century. Does it get any worse than that?
Okay.
That the clarifies. Vengeance.
There wouldn't have been Versailles had they, it would have been a more equitable settlement to the wars.
Because
may not have had Hitler, maybe.
Well, first off, no, you wouldn't have had Hitler, because the Germans could not refield their armies that had left. The French could not have refielded their armies, so there would not have been Versailles. This was like the movie The Last Man Standing, were the American troops. Yeah. The British were not standing. The French were not standing. The Germans were not standing. So there we were. The Americans were standing, and we were the heroes. And old Woodrow Wilson was basking in this light. Woodrow Wilson was not the great president we made him out to be. Believe me, he was not.
I thank you for the clarification, but back to the other question, is war necessary in any sense? Or can you cite specific conflicts, battles?
I know of no war in history that did not beget more war.
But that kind of dodges the question very skillfully.
No, that doesn't dodge the question. I know of no war that has not begotten more war.
Is it necessary, though?
I don't know if it's necessary. I don't know if it's necessary. You attack me, I got to kill you. Then your brother says, well, you killed me, I got... The famous American cowboy story. You know, vengeance is wreaks more vengeance. What kind of a question is it? Maybe the question you got to ask is take the question from Jesus. Turn the other cheek, and maybe you won't get the other cheek whopped off.
Okay.
Civil disobedience.
Yeah.
Could be an answer, although we don't necessarily promote that idea in the book. But
yeah,
the Second World War, I think we portray, and I think Mike mostly agrees, was justified.
Of course, Hitler was a nutcase, but by that time we're too far down the road.
Yeah.
When you want to stop the clock and say, oh, now this is a just war. Sure, it's a just war, but how did we get there? There's a continuum of history,
If war is another form of politics, you better change the politics to avoid the war.
Yeah.
Or the structure of human governance.
Well, if we are in a continuum that has war, and war begets war, and begets war, and begets war, I'm wondering then how we get out of this particular continuum.
Maybe what you ought to do is get out of the continuum of the structure of the nation state. And every state is a selfish, their interest is ours and screw you. And so you have a nation state system that everybody is their interest first, and so it's beggar thy neighbor. And so you have a world of beggar thy neighbor, and so what you have is a world of violence as opposed to a world of love. There's enough in this world for everybody to live prosperously. But we human beings are so incapacitated with our greed and stupidity that we can't share it intelligently.
But this also goes back to what we were talking about fear, how essentially we deserve this government because we live in fear. We deserve this government, we deserve this world because we live in war?
That's right, because we human beings haven't grown up. We haven't grown up. And our representative government is a system that's designed to maintain citizens and civic adolescence. You give your power away and then you blame them for doing it. And what is civic adolescence? Oh, I want a road, but I don't want to be taxed. I want this, but I don't want to pay for it. That's an adolescent. Just look at your kids. And what do? You turn around and you give your kids responsibility and let them take responsibility, and then they grow up, and you hope they grow up and they'll leave and go start their own families. That's called responsibility. So the minute that Americans start making laws, make mistakes, pay the price for it, they'll grow up. And then what happens when you have civic responsibility? Then stop and think what happens. We'll have responsible people in the polity. Right now, we have civic irresponsibility in the polity that carries over into our personal lives, our spiritual lives, and our institutional lives. Isn't that a kettle of fish we live in?
Yeah.
I want to ask you a question. Had Colin Powell resigned and said, this is false, we have false threats that we're talking about, this war should not happen, if if the press did its job and actually reported what the facts were about Iraq and that the UN had not finished its weapons of mass destruction. To plug myself, Arianna Huffington, her new book, Right is Wrong, she has me as a number one in her honor roll of journalists who didn't buy Bush's lies about the war. We were so few of us. And that was prompted because Judy Miller had said the day before I was talking to Arianna on the phone once about we all got it wrong in the press. Well, it wasn't true, but the majority did. Had they all gotten it right? Had Powell, had Richard Clark stood out and resigned, would there have been a war? So it comes down to not, I don't think people are warlike. I think leaders had an agenda here and they sold that war. And too many people who are afraid for their careers and or live vicariously for power sell the war for them because they think they're going to get some of the booty somehow. People have to be courageous, like Dan Ellsberg, who gave Mike the Pentagon Papers, and Mike Revelle, who read the papers in the Congress. You got to step out sometime and even put your the truth and the country before your family and your career. And we don't, there aren't enough people like that around, obviously. So then you have the Powell, Colin Powell, whose reputation was ruined. He had a chance.
They have to be courageous in the light of the fact that habeas corpus has been suspended. They
it's
have to
more
be...
than, more than courageous. It's self-evident. You look at what's right, and you just do what's right. Yeah. Is it so? Is that courageous, to look at something that's right? Here, you see somebody on the street that needs help. You help them across the street. I mean, that's the good boy scout. What's so courageous? Here, stop and think. If one person, in the only time since I've left the Senate, and I left it disgusted, the only time I've wished I had been in the Senate was on October 11, 2002. I'd have filibustered that resolution, and I'd have embarrassed them. It had never passed. All you needed was one senator to do that.
Yeah.
Not one. Here, and it's proven, my court case proved 5-4 that any member of Congress could release any secret and it couldn't be touched. Has any member of Congress, they're all playing, I got a secret.
Yeah.
Dick Durbin said, I knew that that was all lies of the intelligence, but I couldn't tell the American people because it was classified. Rubbish. Mike Gravel's case proved...
And can't be touched?
He can say he can reveal any classified information in this on the Senate floor, cannot be touched. We may not have had a war. I'll add that to the other things that could have happened to prevent that war. If Dick Durbin had had the guts to do something.
A million people would be alive today that are not alive today. And then we look at, Bill Clinton, you know, with here. I even questioned George Bush on Desert War One. He could have talked Absolutely. His protege, Saddam Hussein, out of Kuwait. It was his protege.
Yeah.
He could have talked him.
The Arab League was in the middle of negotiations, and they cut it down. I mean, they wanted that war.
Yeah.
Why? Why did he want the war?
They didn't need it.
They're going to make profits. The military-industrial complex.
Raytheon, Patriot Missile.
Hey, how do they make it? They got to have war. They got to expend munitions, because if they don't expend munitions, they can't make any money.
I'm glad you brought up Dick Durbin, because I actually had a question in relation to that, and that is, what of the defamation suit against Murtha? The same principle there is just as evident, and yet there are these peripheral threats too towards congressmen, towards senators.
Well,
you can speak freely about
Murtha has been one of the greatest hawks in the government for the military industrial complex. I mean, he's Mr. Moneybags for the military industrial complex, like Stevens is in the Senate. Come on,
but he still is protected by the speech or debate clause, and yet this defamation suit came, and he was therefore threatened. His stature was threatened because there are these outside influences. So it seems that if the government is a representative of this fear of the people, the government itself is fearful of this. So we almost can't win. I mean, this act of courage.
You can win. All people have to do is just stand up.
Who would you defame if you said that there was a bunch of lies about the intelligence on Iraq? Who would he have defamed? Bush? I mean, that didn't apply, really. Durbin could have come forward. I don't know if that's...
What I'm talking about here is this defamation suit, and then all of a sudden...
Clue the audience in.
Well, this is the defamation suit that was brought by Frank Werderich. You remember that one?
I don't, to be honest.
Yeah, there was a defamation suit, and there were some criticisms of this because Murtha was, of course, behind the speech or debate clause. And therefore protected
and
from
Woolridge.
This defamation.
Woolridge.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, Woolridge. Who's he?
Yeah.
Tell me who he is.
He is a guy who considered himself defamed because he was part of the troops, and these were actually in government documents.
No, who is he? Give his title. I know the name. I can't put his title to it, But and so I don't want to defame him because my memory doesn't serve me. But I think I could do a better job on him than Mirtha did. But I don't have the facts. So let's not inject something that we don't have enough facts.
Oh, okay,
on.
Fair enough. But let's go back to this idea of doing what's right versus courageous. Okay, all of us in this room can, in fact, help a homeless person in the street, and that's a decent thing to do. But we're talking about a government here that is not going to be doing its job. I mean, honestly,
one of the failures of our society is that we take the individual and we hold the individual here and we take the government there and we think there's a difference. There is no difference. If you are immoral as an individual, then the government is just as immoral. You've heard the joke, I kill you, that's murder. I kill a million people, that's foreign policy. It is not any different. It's exactly the same thing. And so when you turn around under Bill Clinton, you kill 500,000 children in Iraq with sanctions, when you don't need any sanctions, 500,000 children. And then when Madeleine, and that's not disputable, incidentally, by anybody, and Madeleine Albright was asked, which says, well, you know, is worth it, is collateral damage. It's not worth it. It's rank immorality. That's what it is. And so when we think like that as a nation, that we're so superior, that we are become tone deaf morally, and that's what we are in the world today. We Americans are tone deaf morally. There's something really wrong at home. And so when we act immorally as a nation, we are immoral as a people, and we ought to begin to start realizing that.
One last question, and this is in relation to Scoop Jackson, who you stood up with for against.
I read the book.
Yes, okay. I did. But I want to ask you, because you stood up against the ABM, and then you turned around and prevented his energy bill from passing in revenge. But
a little more than revenge. I had some justification. There was some matters in there about nuclear activity that I opposed.
Yeah.
Now, I might, in a normal situation, I would have eaten my opposition and said, well, you know, shoot, Scoop Jackson's a powerful guy. I'm a freshman. Maybe I don't want to attack him. But I took a little bit of courage and said, screw him. He wants to play tough. I'll show him what tough is.
But the question is that were you able to, I mean, did you have to use him in any cooperative sense when you were in the Senate any time throughout your two terms? I mean, if you brawl against a particular senator, even one who is hawkish, like Jackson clearly was, I'm wondering if, I mean, this goes again back to this idea of, well, whether are the Democrats who are being feeble right now in government, are they in fact conducting deals, necessary deals to get other forms of legislation across? I mean, alienating Jackson is fine
to
dandy.
But the answer to your question is real simple. You got a choice when you go to the Senate. You can be along and go along. You can turn around and just be a wimp. You can turn around and say, I want to accomplish certain things. It goes against the grain. The minute you start doing that, you start alienating some people, and then they start cuffing you a little bit, and then you can turn around and wimp off on that. Or you can get goddamn tough and fight for what you believe in, and you pay a price when you fight. And so it's a tough set of facts. So when you take on the giants, you got to be prepared to suffer the consequences. And I took them on. I took on Scoop Jackson over nuclear matters, John Pastore, and others. And they turned around and muscled me. Whenever they did it to me, I gave it back to them in kind because I read the rules, and I used the rules to stick it down their throat, and they didn't like it. And so it's just that simple. In the Senate of the United States, if you got the guts, you can stand up to them. And if you're tough enough, they'll leave you alone. Whenever I threatened filibuster, they would walk around the desk and leave me alone. I may not have had their love, but I sure had their fear. And I had their respect for a lot of them because people like Jake Javits and others, boy, I had their friendship. Hubert Humphrey, I had his respect and friendship. And they would help me when they weren't seen, they would help me. Mike Mansfield helped me.
Cranston
helped me. A lot of them would help me. They didn't want to be up front, but they would help me because they knew that a lot of people were out there to stick it to me. And I could take it. And peer pressure is the toughest kind of pressure you can get. And I had peer pressure for all of my career in the Senate.
It takes toughness then to fight against war while we are in a state of war. It takes fear to fight fear. It takes celebrity politics to fight for pure politics that are more predicated on principle. Is that what you're saying here?
What I'm saying is...
The weapons life, you have at your disposal.
Well, hey, who said life was going to be easy, huh? I don't know. I don't know who said that, but I never heard that. And I was born on the other side of the tracks. And all I know is that life is difficult for me, and I don't regret, and I'm a happy camper.
Okay, well, fair enough. Thank you both very much for taking out the time.
Heaven knows we try, but all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? They're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll try.